quite a few other places, you know. You know, difficulty is raised on this ground.
Also with
Plato draws our attention very strikingly to this. I pointed out that this transition from the political to the kingly art, and correspondingly from citizens to human beings, you know. Plato meant this quite seriously. Regarded this as important. But it was not regarded as important by Crito.
In a way, when Socrates shifts there from the political and citizens to kingly and human beings, that seems to make part of his argument weaker there, in that, as you were saying to Mr. Barris, that you know, all the citizens do make others, or think, like to think of themselves at least as making others good, just as the king does. Now it seems much less true in a monarchy than in a republic.
Now let me, I do not know whether that is a sufficient answer, but you can correct me or tell me when I'm wrong. There is a simpler link-up. If Crito is in the first place a private man, a gentleman farmer, then his position on the farm and in the greatest possible indifference to the polis is, of course, that of an absolute ruler. I mean, surely he is subject to the city, to the laws of Athens, but within these limits, he is a boss, he is a master, he is a king. So that precisely there is a connection between the master of the household and the king, in contradistinction to the republican magistrate, which would explain why Crito finds no difficulty in that. This, I believe, is confirmed to some extent by Xenophon's Economicus, this point.
Would that be related to why Socrates at 292 A1 uses the rule in connection with farming? And the whole shift here from using to ruling?
No, ruling comes in the moment the political outcome, or kingly outcomes.
Also, you said, when this is quite separate, you said when talking about Crito accepting that Socrates had made up the climate, that Socrates had said the speech is attributed to Clinias, that it was clear to us that Socrates wouldn't have said those things. Then it becomes clear to us that Socrates wouldn't have said those things. I wasn't quite clear.
Well, Socrates did not, well, oh, well, Socrates, I think Socrates would probably not have dismissed dialectics in such a cavalier manner as it was dismissed by Clinias. Clinias mentions only dialectics for a moment when he speaks of the mathematicians, but he doesn't stop for one moment to wonder what is the status of dialectics itself. Is not perhaps dialectics the desired science? He leaves it at saying that the mathematical sciences are not the desired science.
That may sound stupid, but if Socrates didn't say it, who did say those speeches?
Who? Socrates made them up and put them into the mouth of Clinias when speaking to Crito. Socrates had said at the beginning, don't forget, that he called on the muses, not only on memory, but also her daughters. The muses should inspire him, and therefore it is clear that there will be quite a few falsehoods here. And one we have surely discovered.
Are we to think that Crito doesn't realize that Socrates made it up, but just thinks Socrates said it then?
Yeah, so I think Crito thinks that Socrates has made it up just now, right? While telling that part of the story.
it seems strange that immediately, at 291A, that immediately after admitting that Socrates has made it up, Plato then asked, well, did you find the art? That seems to presume that the conversation did take place.
Yes, that the conversation took place is undeniable. Plato was present and saw these people and heard even some words. There is no doubt about that. But what was the whole conversation escaped him. And because Ctesippus, then you remember the story, what happened. Ctesippus had blocked the access blocked the access of Plato to philosophy. And the motive of Ctesippus was his love of Cleinias. This is the whole situation. But Socrates was, of course, free to tell and to invent anything at any stage. But we have no right to assume that he invented something, some other things. Here in this case, we are entitled, because Crito's skepticism points to it, and Socrates practically admits it. Mr. Panger.
I wanted to return for a minute to the question of politics being a making art. It seemed to me that although he uses the word making at 291D3, that there had been something changed, because up to this point, I thought that the demand that the supreme art be a making art meant that it be an art that makes the means which it uses, not an art that has a final product. In other words, that the demand that it be a making art seemed to correct the problem in the first proceptic that we saw, that somehow using doesn't explain how you got what you use.
I see. So let us use, therefore, a clearer term. There is an art which, I mean, making is only one kind of getting things. Another, hunting is another. Making, hunting, and let us call making and hunting together acquiring. Whether you acquire through hunting, as if, say, a fish, well, it's not exactly hunting in present-day usage, but in the wider sense, of course, it's, or whether you acquire something by making it, like a table, both are acquisitive arts. So we need, what we want, to have an art which is acquisitive and using. Yeah. Now the question is dialectics not an art which is both? The expression hunting is applied by Plato frequently to a dialectics. Hunting, finding things, appropriating them, and then of course looking at them and learning something through them. The more practical problem is this. The dialectician must have some means of livelihood, otherwise he could not be a dialectician. And the dialectical art is wholly unable to procure him the livelihood. He needs, in addition, some form of the economic art in order to live. Is this what you mean?
Yeah.
That is, I think, true, but it is here not the theme. But although his theme is pointed to.
I mean, given that Socrates seems to have made up the speeches that were attributed to Cleinias, I mean, I wonder how much of this section of the conversation from yesterday, which he tells one is supposed to assume is made up, and how much of it is real. In particular, was there a second speech with Cleinias, and did it indeed end in an aporia, if not in precisely the way he tells it in some way? Because that seems to be sort of necessary.
It's very hard to answer your question because the evidence which we have is so scanty. We know that there was a conversation between Socrates and at least Euthydemus. this Plato himself had observed, this is a firm datum. Everything beyond that is open to doubts, but the doubt is rather aimless if you do not have something specific to support it, you know? And we have something specific only in the case of these special, these peculiar remarks of Plotinus about dialectics and the generalship. So I think that is not very fruitful to enter into this, unless you find somewhere an allusion which we have overlooked, which is of course always possible.
With regard to that, I wondered if it wasn't somewhat significant that when Socrates began the whole story, he said, I will try and as I think. But then at some times, like it, after the first Projectic, he didn't give any qualification. He just said, I said these things, Crito, and then he said, then he began this amazing argument without any qualification, if there was any importance in the fact that sometimes he seems to say, I think, and sometimes not.
Which is the great word which you mean?
That 272d9, he says, I will try to go through.
Yes.
But then at 283b1, the following, he doesn't say anything like that. He just says, he began this amazing argument, then tell me, O Socrates, as if there's less doubt in his mind that this was exactly what was said.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean... In other words, he says at the beginning that he will try to remember, to tell everything from the beginning. There is also the reference to the Muses somewhere, somewhat later on. But otherwise, there are no references to... Very rarely occur remarks, then I believe... He said, yeah? This is whether there is a reason to assume that these particular passages where he says, I believe, that they are invented in that very moment by Socrates, I do not know. One would have to go again over the whole dialogue and see whether a pattern emerges out of that. It could be. Well, if, yes.
Since Socrates hasn't really considered, at least for Crito, and as far as we know with Clinias, the possibility of a dialectical art, there seems to be a certain problem with the seriousness of the aporia as far as Socrates himself is concerned. He may himself not have been altogether convinced that the brother's art is absolutely necessary.
Surely not. That is a question which we still have to answer. What is the meaning of this whole strange dialogue?
Well, I'd like to ask a minor question connected with this. I mean, there is a certain parallel between what Socrates is presented, if nothing else, as a pupil of two sorts of sciences in this dialogue. One is the brothers, and the other is of Conus, the Citharist, which is another using art. One, again, which presumably is some sort of partial good, but one which is certainly not simply a dialectical or word-making sort of art.
And not a high art.
What seems to come out of this is that, well, just as at the end of the first Protectic, he had left two possibilities open, one of which was that there is a particular form of knowledge, the other which would make us happy. The other is that all knowledge makes us happy, the acquisition of all knowledge. One of the two, there is no choice but that one of the two be the correct answer. So are we to begin with, to suppose that although the evidence isn't here presented, very fully, we do have some indications that the seriousness is due to the fact that one needs all knowledge and that partial knowledge. of any sort won't do.
Yeah, but one needs comprehensive knowledge. But this comprehensive knowledge is total knowledge. As a total knowledge is not simply the agglomeration of all parts, of all partial knowledges. Yeah? Then indeed dialectics would be composite out of shoemaker, carpenters, and all the other arts, which is absurd. But what are you aiming at? What is your question aiming at?
Socrates puts up with this nonsense from the brothers just in terms of the situation as we've outlined it so far.
Yeah.
That is, it doesn't seem clear that from with regard to his relation with Cleinias, it seems very necessary.
Yeah, I think we have to do something which is strictly forbidden by all rules of the game. I mean, just as in reading detective stories, a decent detective story reader will never look up at the end, because in this way he will deprive himself of the greatest enjoyment. In the same way, we should not go to the end. But on the other hand, there are some respectable reasons why in our case it is not immoral to do so. I mean, insofar as it may help us to state the questions more clearly. Now, the result of the protracted course would be in Greek, philosophiteon, in Latin, philosophandum est. In English, one must philosophize. Hmm? Is this clear? Philosophy is necessary. This is, of course, in no way surprising as an assertion of Socrates. I think no one in this room, even if he or she has never read a Platonic dialogue, is not surprised by this assertion. And may I ask the question why it is not surprising that Socrates should have said, one must philosophize? How does everyone know that this is a Socratic assertion? What is the most obvious source of your knowledge that Socrates said one must philosophize? It's a very simple question, though I may have stated it awkwardly. Pardon? Apology, sure. Apology, and do you remember particularly impressive passages there? Pardon?
The unexamined life is not.
Yeah, and
even
also,
if I were if I were told I could live, but without philosophizing,
that's the best I have in mind. Now, what does more specifically, if you Athenians came down and would say, "All right, Socrates, we let you alone; nothing will happen to you, but you must promise not to philosophize anymore." And Socrates would say, "I love you, Athenians, but I can't promise it because I can't keep that promise." Good. Now, what does this seemingly fictitious case mean in more precise language, or more intelligible language? The Athenians offer to Socrates amnesty under one condition: that from now on there will be a law. Philosophizing is strictly forbidden, penalty death. Yeah? Was there such a law in Athens?
The laws about the gods.
The laws say you must not question the gods worshipped by the city of Athens, amounted by implication to a prohibition against philosophy. Because philosophers would, of course, have to examine that. So we can say that was not only a fictitious offer, but it referred to an actual fact. There was a law forbidding philosophy. And now we come to the companion dialogue of the apology, the Crito. What is situation is a crisis. The question is not merely whether Socrates should leave, run away from jail. This is, of course, more the immediate problem. But it is enlarged by that, in that speech, by the laws. And what do the laws say, if we reduce it to a single proposition?
Obey us because you owe everything to us.
Yes, for a variety of reasons, and these reasons are very various, for a variety of reasons, you have to obey all laws. Therefore, the message of the apology and the message of the Kriton flatly contradict one another. And to that extent, the popular notion that in the apology, Socrates is presented as a kind of Herbert Marcuse, and in the Kriton is presented as a kind of very conservative old gentleman, yeah, is justified. Socrates the rebel, as they call it, is the apology, and Socrates the conservative in the Kriton. I mean, that is not wholly, you know, such popular notions are not always unfounded. They are always stupid, that I grant, but one cannot dismiss them. Good. Now let us consider for one moment who is the interlocutor in the Kriton. Who is the interlocutor in the Kriton? Kriton. Then he must not be ashamed to give such symbolizing. So the Kriton. So is it not very, very fit then that Kriton, that when speaking to Kriton, Socrates should not say, one must philosophize. This is to what I alluded today when I said we must consider for one moment when Kriton takes the place of Cleinias, could Socrates have urged on Kriton to philosophize? Could he have urged on Kriton's sons toward philosophizing? I think the answer is no. The trouble is only that Kriton has a kind of unhappy love for philosophy. And Socrates must make the best of it. And the best of it in these circumstances is to say, well, why not give a try to Eudemus? I make it as somewhat less serious than it is. But after all, the situation has its very serious side. Kriton is Socrates' oldest friend, so to speak, and yet he lived with Socrates for 70 years together, and he understood relatively little of what Socrates thought. I mean, that is a very sad thing, and by no means comical, but I do not deny that it has also its comical side. I believe we have to read the dialogue to the end before we have reached that point, we cannot answer this question. I only thought we should experiment a bit with such a look at what might happen later. Surely, generally speaking, when you read the apology, you get the impression that Socrates is a kind of Uncle Sam pointing his finger at each one, saying, did you philosophize today? Yeah? That is the impression which he creates. Is it not true? And yet, if you don't have to make excavations, you only have to read the other Platonic dialogues and see, where do you find that Socrates? In which dialogue? Nowhere. You have the impression that Socrates is all the time at the marketplace, at the benches of the money changers, and asking all the people, what is justice? What is courage? And or at least encourage them to practice virtue. Where do you find that? If you make a list, as a statistics, which is not so difficult to make, of the people with whom Socrates converses, there are very few ordinary Athenian citizens to whom he talks. They are mostly young people, or foreign sophists, or rhetoricians, or poets, a few times active politicians, very rare. So Socrates, the gadfly, is not borne out by the Platonic dialogues. And if you want to know the reason, you have to consider what Socrates himself is made by Plato to say in the Gorgias. What would you do? That is a question more as put to Socrates by Callicles. What would you do if you were accused by the Athenians for your conduct? And Socrates says, well, I would be in the position of a physician accused by the candy maker before a jury of children. And they would, of course, condemn the physician with his injections and bitter pills and be all in favor of the candy maker. Now, what would he do? And what could Socrates do? He could, of course, not explain to these kids. He could say it was for your benefit, but the children wouldn't understand it. He has to speak in a language which his children understand. That is exactly what Socrates does in the Apology. He explains to this grown-up children, the Athenian citizenry, what he did in a language which they can understand. And when we read the Republic carefully, we see that properly understood, what we know from the other dialogues comes out from the Republic, from the text of the Apology itself. And so I believe that the cleavage between the Apology and the Crito supplies ultimately the key to the Eudaimonia, or more precisely, it is the most simple starting point for us if you want to simplify procedures to link up Eudaimonia with these two dialogues, and especially considering that the relation is particularly close to the Crito, given the fact that Crito is a man to whom Socrates tells this story here. Yes.
Would there be a distinction between the Xenophon, Socrates, and the Platonic Socrates? Wouldn't Xenophon describe Socrates as going to the marketplace and in fact being kind of like that one talking to people?
Yes. No, in Xenophon you have at least one example of Socrates as a stump orator. I mean, standing as if he were standing on a low elevation and preaching to the Athenians and telling them that they should be virtuous. In the third chapter of the Republic, you can read that. And where this beautiful phrase occurs, he who has sons to educate a father who dies and leaves sons to educate and daughters to watch. Yes. But I would say there is a difference. It is as if Plato and Xenophon had a kind of secret agreement that Xenophon limits himself to the lower part of a statue and Plato to the upper part. But there is full, otherwise there is full agreement.
I would agree, but I would accept that. but I was just going to suggest that the Platonic Socrates would probably be a Socrates who would learn from the original. In other words,
one who, came after Socrates, and was Plato, and so it happened to Socrates. And therefore, doesn't kind of choose Socrates in this very public sort of sphere at all.
Yeah, well, that is very hard to say. The historic Socrates is beyond our reach. We have only the Platonic and Xenophonic, and if you please, the Aristophanian Socrates. I mean, there are certain things which are facts. For example, that Socrates behaved decently in that trial of the generals of the Argonusa. And the simple sign of that is that Xenophon in his Greek history mentions it. Characteristically mentioning there Socrates with his patronymic, Socrates the son of Sophroniscus. In other words, treating Socrates just as an Athenian citizen, like any other Athenian citizen who behaved in a very law-abiding manner. I must confess that I did not quite was unable to follow you.
What I'm getting at is that Plato obviously learned something from Socrates and really admired him.
Yeah.
And I'm suggesting that Socrates, the historic Socrates, probably did go off and into the marketplace. Now, it's pure speculation, of course.
Yeah, sure.
But,
if you admit this, all right.
But the point is, he was brought to trial for something like that. He was brought to trial for something like that. He was accused of it.
Of what?
He was accused of going out and disturbing people and upsetting them.
No, he was accused of not believing in the, not worshiping or not holding in honor the gods held in honor by the city of Athens, and of corrupting the young.
Okay. Corrupting the young, but in a way which the other people could observe and were disappointed and upset.
Yes, and well, what they thought was that, for example, two people who were connected with Socrates in their youth, called Alcibiades and Critias, did Athens quite a bit of harm.
And what I'm suggesting is that Plato is much more prudent man, and that he cast his Socrates in a much more unpublic.
Sure.
But he only talks to him like he said, strangers and particular young men, but never in the marketplace and things like that. In other words, his Socrates isn't going to get in that sort of trouble.
Yeah, but on the other hand, there are years in a way. Surely that was part. I mean, the fact that both Plato and Xenophon wrote each a book called Apology of Socrates. And the name of Socrates occurs in no other title of their works, indicates, I believe, also that their whole work is an apology of Socrates. Their whole work. No, an apology, of course, necessarily plays down the things which could be used for an accusation and plays up those which could not be used.
But it doesn't want to himself.
But as for the question that we are, no one is ever, was able, is able, or will ever be able to say, this and these things in Plato go back to Socrates, and the others are Plato's own invention. This is exactly what Plato wished to be the case, because he credited Socrates with everything he ever thought. And this is a sign. If it is a sign of ambition to write books, if it is a sign of ambition, then Plato made good what he did wrong in writing books by giving Socrates the credit for everything. I mean, there is a singular act of absence of base philotimia, base ambition.
It's also very prudent, meaning, as Socrates did writing books, he rather talked to other people. Plato wrote books, but he attributed everything to Socrates.
Yeah, but still, Plato, there is a very famous remark of Plutarch in his Nicias, in his biography of Nicias, in which he describes the situation as it was prior to Plato's time in Athens, and philosophy was persecuted and had a very bad reputation, and that Plato, owing to his transcendent genius, changed the situation radically. I think that is simply a historical fact. That philosophy is something which is taken for granted, and we owe to Plato more than to any other human being.
To go back to what you said before, that the difference between the apology and the credo is in a way the key for the Nicodemus, because from the putting the apology and the credo together, we come up with a conclusion that you don't tell credo to philosophize. But that, I mean, that seems to imply that you can tell the assembled Athenians that one must philosophize, or the philosophy is important.
But the question is, well, I'm sorry, I do not, my memory is not so very good at the moment. What precisely did Socrates tell the Athenians to do? As a listener to the apology, what do you understand by philosophizing there? Yeah, sure, on the one hand, examine yourself. And this can mean something very innocent. You know, has very little to do with philosophy in any precise sense. I mean, find out whether you are tolerably decent or not. As the second point is to exhort people to virtue. Philosophizing in any more precise sense is not something which Socrates says that he tried to exhort people to. What Socrates did to claim to have done is something, you know, to remind them of their ignorance. And that is a simple and important negative thing, that they know how little they know about the most important things, to bring that home to them.
Shares the general's concern in achieving victory. Shares the not only the trials of defeat, but the glories of victory. And this kind of suggests we talked about presidential candidates and what they provide as well. That isn't the most important thing, but there's something exciting to talk about.
And what do they give us?
Presidential candidates. And they give us the most important gift they give us is something exciting to talk about. In other words, ruling. And it goes back to something that goes with my understanding, precisely to what we're talking about and what I was talking about. All people can, to use a common vote word, participate in ruling insofar as they talk about it. And they talk about the same things that the men who are actually ruling.
Yes.
And you also may mention back into all men, even the man up in the who uses bioelectric, have to go back into the cave. So I was going to suggest that I take that to mean that he has to eat. And if he has to eat, well, there's another way, which I thought the Greeks provide very well for, especially Athens. And if they could get everybody to eat with them, in other words, if they set up the common tables where everybody could be admitted, then everybody could, you know, fill their body. But the men who invited them and provided for the banquet could talk to them. And so they sit there and they, you know, have all kinds of food, but they'd also be able to listen to the city's leaders.
This is all meant to illustrate that the ruler and the ruled are happy in the same way.
Yes.
Yeah.
And when the ruler rules well, everybody, you know, senses it and partakes you know, gets happiness.
And some contribution on the part of the ruled is also required. Yeah. Just as in the case of the army. Otherwise the general wouldn't be a good general. Yes. So we had this long discussion, which I believe we got something out of our systems, and wasn't too bad. But we have, of course, next time, 2 weeks from today, if everything goes well, we have to come to the last big scene when the brothers come to Sugata's assistance and try to get him out of his predicament by their monkey tricks, which they used already before. And we will do that next time.